gave way to deism, which gave way to naturalism in both its optimistic and pessimistic forms, which eventually led to existentialism and eventually to New Age pantheism on one side and on postmodernism on the other side. And so even Stanley Grenz, who I don't agree with on a lot of his stuff, although he wrote an outstanding primer on postmodernism, but even Stanley Grenz acknowledges that when we're trying to witness the postmodernists, our biggest competition are people who proclaim that man is God. So what he's saying is the people most likely, well, just the number one competitor with Christianity to try to lead postmodernists to Christ are New Agers. And I do think postmodernism is going to give way to New Age type thing. But the New Age movement has been so embarrassing for so long that they're going to have to come up with a different name for it, like neo-spirituality, or, you know, just give it some kind, just a different name and some kind of intellectual justification of it. Which, you know, we're talking foolishness here. I mean, the intellectual justification of the rejection of the intellect, you know, a rational justification, a rational defense of the meaningless of reason. You know, it just doesn't really make much sense. Tell you what, if you look at your notes, we have worldviews on the front page, or do you even have worldviews on the front page? There's a page with the. What I want to do now, I'm being spontaneous here. I've given you how Sire handles it from a historical standpoint. Now we want to look at the worldviews and just give a really quick overview. We already mentioned what they are, but I don't believe I gave a refutation of them yet, right? Okay. I'm just going to give you a quick refutation of each of these because we're not going to cover all these. If you notice, panentheism isn't on the board. Finite godism isn't on the board. Polytheism isn't on the board. So I just want to go over the seven different worldviews and give a quick refutation. And then as we deal with them historically, we'll also do an ideological refutation of them as we spend more time with some of these. But for atheism, atheism, again, is the belief that there is no God. And just a quick refutation of that, and we'll spend some time today on evidence for God's existence, where we defend theism and refute atheism. But just a quick refutation, there's no adequate explanation for the existence of the universe, intelligent design, or morality. Atheism fails as a worldview because there's no adequate explanation for the existence of the universe, intelligent design, or morality. You know, an inconsistent atheist is going to say, yeah, there are absolute moral laws that apply to all people at all times and all places. The question to him is, where do you get them from? If there's no God, there's no absolute moral law giver above all mankind, where do these moral laws come from? It doesn't make sense. What's that? What I just said right now? Yeah, you can have an inconsistent atheist who's going to say, oh yeah, I believe in absolute moral laws that apply to all people in all times and all places. The question here is, why? It doesn't make sense. It's excess baggage to the atheistic worldview. But to a consistent atheist who acknowledges, okay, yeah, there's no God, so there's no absolute moral laws, okay, they can't live that way. Because if there's no absolute moral laws, then why do they always protest to try to take Christianity out of the schools? As if it's the right thing to do. You know, why do they get politically active as if it's the right thing to do? You could add, by the way, no adequate explanation for the existence of the universe, intelligent design, or morality. And you could also add to that, it's not livable. You know, nobody can live consistently with the atheistic worldview. Now, again, here we're just rushing through this, but we're going to spend more time on, we'll probably spend at least one session, you know, the 3 hours just on atheism and breaking it down a little bit more. Pantheism is the belief that God is the universe. Belief that God is the universe. Write small on this. There's so many things you could say on this. For refutation, it fails to explain the existence of evil. Remember, in pantheism, all distinctions, everything is one. So there's no distinctions that are ultimately real. Even the distinction between good and evil is not ultimately real. So it fails to explain the existence of evil. Most pantheists hold to reincarnation. But the problem there, we talked about this last week, for reincarnation to occur, physical bodies have to exist and individual souls have to exist. Because for reincarnation to occur, an individual soul has to be reincarnated in a different physical body. Problem is, pantheism teaches that there are no such things. Ultimately, physical bodies aren't real, and individual souls aren't real, because everything is one world soul. Okay? So, you know, again, that's contradictory. Another problem with pantheism, pantheists argue that since God is beyond reason, beyond rational categories, that God is unknowable. But the problem with that is, if God is unknowable, how can we know pantheism is true? If God is unknowable, how can we know pantheism is true? Yeah, there are literally thousands of people making millions of dollars writing books arguing that there is no such thing as truth. It's almost like they're saying there is no such thing as truth, and this is the hottest new truth that you really got to hear my views on the subject. I mean, if there is no truth, I don't want to hear your views, because there's no way your views could be true. So, but again, keep in mind what we said last week. The statement, what's wrong with the statement, there is no absolute truth?
If that was true.
Yeah, if that's true, it's an absolute truth, so it has to be false. Therefore, we know that absolute truth exists. And then the statement, man cannot know truth, if that's true, then we could at least know that truth. So there's at least two things we should know there, that truth exists and man can know it. Consistent pantheists argue that the world is an illusion, but no one can live like the world is an illusion. You know, I never met a guru. You know, who hasn't eaten in 20 years. Okay, so. So, yeah, you know, the food that's placed in front of this guy is an illusion, supposedly, but he eats these illusions 3 times a day, just like the Christian who acknowledges the existence of things like McDonald's and Burger King. No incentive to be moral, or little, or maybe even little incentive to be moral. There's two ways that I see this principle applying. Little incentive to be moral. We're in India. You're suffering. Okay? And what's your first name? James? Okay, me. Just log this in before I forget. You're suffering. So it's James Sessa? Okay. You're suffering, and I'm a nice guy, so I'm thinking of helping alleviate your suffering. Okay? However, there's a problem. I'm a Hindu, and I'm serious about my Hindu beliefs. And if I help alleviate your sufferings, you can't suffer and work off that negative karma that is slowing down your attainment of nirvana. So you're all caught up in the reincarnation process. If I help alleviate your sufferings, then you have to be reincarnated and suffer for that negative karma in the next life. So the nicest thing I can do for you is to leave you alone and allow you to suffer, okay? And that's why most of the hospitals, they're built by either Christians or Hindus who are Hindu in name only. They've given up on their Hindu beliefs, okay? So, yeah, the caste system.
You're born into the low end, and you got to work up the
Yeah, whatever class in the caste system that you're born into, you're damned to be there and work off negative karma your whole life. You can never leave that caste in this life. You might be able to leave it in the next life and all. And so he has a vicious system. Now, that was one of the reasons for the founding of Buddhism, and Jainism was the rejection of the Hindu caste system. But I think the Hindu belief system is more consistent than what Buddha or the Jains have done with that. But here's another area where there's no reason to be moral. Suppose you want to do a bad thing. You really want to do this evil thing. In Christianity, we can say, don't do this evil thing because it's wrong. God will be upset with you. In pantheistic worldview, it's kind of like, don't do this evil thing because it's going to slow down your escape from the cycle of reincarnation. Well, you might say, well, this evil thing is more important to me than escaping reincarnation. You know? And so all it's going to do, if you want to punch a guy in the nose, it might slow things down, but it might be worth it for you. So, you had a question, James? There are different segments, different branches of Hinduism that would promote asceticism, self-mutilation, or depriving the body of certain things. Some gurus have become famous for walking around for decades naked with cow dung in their hair. And, the thing is, too, the people will look, a lot of Hindus will look up to these gurus. But that's how far, you throw God out the window, you profess to be wise, you become fooled, right back to Romans 1. There are some that will do that, because the physical world is an illusion, let's beat our bodies. And then you'll get some gurus, just like the ancient Gnostics, were this, you could go either way. You could go asceticism, beat the body, or promiscuity. A guru that came over here to Oregon, Bhagwan Rajneesh, he was having sex with dozens of different people. And in his way of thinking, because the physical realm is an illusion, I can do whatever I please. Most gurus from India, because the physical world is an illusion, I need to deprive myself of physical pleasures. So it could go either way there. But I think the biggest refutation of pantheism is this. In pantheistic thinking, everything is one being. Everything is one being. So all reality is one mind. Somehow this is an impersonal mind. Again, I don't understand how a mind could be impersonal. To me, just to be a mind, you have to think, and to be able to think, you'd be personal. But somehow they refer to all reality as one mind, one world soul, okay? So every time a pantheist tries to share his views with a non-pantheist, it's one mind trying to convince another mind that only one mind exists. Okay, so again, it's self-refuting at its core. Panentheism, that's the view that the universe is God's body. They argue that God is both finite, limited, and infinite, unlimited, in his basic nature. Okay? Refutation of this is, it's impossible for God, or for anything that matter, to be both finite and infinite in its basic nature. Okay? How could you say, well, God in his basic nature is both unlimited and limited? You know, that doesn't make sense. It's a contradiction. What ends up happening is God being unlimited gives way to God being limited, and God becomes a limited being. Second thing to put down for the refutation of panentheism, a finite changing God, because that's what the God of panentheism becomes, a finite changing God would need an infinite unchanging God to ground its existence. In other words, once you say that in God's basic nature he has limitations, well, a being with limitations cannot ground its own existence. A being that is totally unlimited must be the ground of all else that exists. Okay? So in other words, the only way to rescue the panentheistic God is by acknowledging the existence of the theistic God. But once you acknowledge the existence of the theistic God, whatever this panentheistic God is, it's not God. Okay? It's not the ultimate. It's something more ultimate to it. Let me ask you this, though. God can't be both finite and infinite in his basic nature, his panentheism. In Christianity, we believe that Jesus is both limited and unlimited because of the incarnation. How can we say panentheism can't be true because God is the idea that God's both finite and infinite in its basic nature is a contradiction, yet how can we hold to Jesus being both infinite and finite? And that not be a contradiction. Okay. He actually didn't give up his powers. If God gave up his powers, he would no longer be God, because God by definition is all powerful. But he did voluntarily choose not to use some of his divine powers. Somebody over here was saying something. I would even say that's too strong a language. I'd say he voluntarily chose. You could say he voluntarily chose not to tap into his. It's not even like Mike Tyson getting an arm amputated. It's not even like Mike Tyson getting his arm tied behind his back. It's just Mike Tyson having that arm and that power and voluntarily choosing to keep it behind his back and not use it, so that Jesus could say, I don't know the day or the hour of my Father's return, yet Jesus is omniscient. He's all-knowing. But he's all-knowing in his divine nature, chose not to tap into it and to rely upon the Father for information, but he didn't know that in his human nature. Okay, so the key here is this. Jesus as God, second person of the Trinity, okay, is unlimited in all his attributes. He's unlimited in his nature as God. But at a point in time, he added a limited human nature. So there's a difference between saying the unlimited God added a limited human nature, so that now he is called, the theologians call it the hypostatic union. Jesus is one person with two natures forever. He always existed as God, but he added a human nature. So he's a complex person that has two natures, an unlimited nature and a limited nature. Okay? But that's not what you have in panentheism. Panentheism is arguing that in God's basic nature, he is both unlimited and limited. That's contradictory. Because the limitations, if it's in the same nature, would automatically make that nature a limited nature.
Are the limitations for the finite attributes that God defined at all, or is it just, is he finite wherever they want him to be finite?
It deals in Thomistic language. If you deal with Thomas Aquinas' thought, the limitations would be our potentiality. That would be the areas, you know, the powers that we have are limited, and all. We're good, but in a limited sense. We're powerful, but in a limited sense. And by the way, it would be impossible for God to create an infinite being. There are some things that, by definition, are impossible for God to do, some things are impossible for God to do because it goes against His good nature. Like it's impossible for God to sin or to lie or to change His mind. And some things are impossible for God to do because it goes against His. It goes against reason, which flows from God. In other words, it's impossible for God to create square circles. Okay. So when the atheist says that if God is all powerful, He could do anything. If God could do anything, He could create a rock that even He can't lift. But then He wouldn't be all powerful. The problem with that is a faulty definition of God being all powerful. God being all powerful does not mean that He can do anything, like create a God greater than Him. Or create a rock that He can't lift. God will always be able to create a rock of enormous size, but as the Creator, He's always going to be able to lift it. And no, God cannot create a God greater than Him. God can't create. Those are nonsensical things. God can't create an uncreated being. Every being that God creates, by definition, will be a created being. Yeah. If you can create it, you can control it. That's exactly. God will always be able to master His creation. So it's a nonsensical question. So really, all powerful means that God is only limited by His own nature. It means no being outside of Himself can limit Him. But it doesn't mean that God can. You know, what the atheist is asking, if God can accomplish all things, then he can fail. No, failing is not an accomplishment. Because God is all-powerful, it means He can never fail. So He can never create a rock that He can't lift, because that implies failure.
Sire talks about in this, theism of proportions, which is kind of freaking a little bit, is talking about the system is open, like the universe is open. It's not programmed. God is constantly evolving the unfolding pattern of the ongoing operation. So are we as human beings, of course, of the world's operation, so reordered by evil.
Yeah, he...
It kind of goes into a little bit more being that we have the ability to kind of direct.
Well, the main point he's getting at, Sire, there in his book is... there's two different ways we could say the universe is open or the universe is closed. There's two different senses in which we can use that. We could say, scientists talk about if the universe is open, that means it's going to keep on expanding throughout all time, and eventually the universe will die. Other scientists say, no, eventually gravity is going to pull it back, so the universe is closed. Okay? That's not the way. That's not the scientific way there. It's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is the universe a closed system, so there's nothing outside the universe that can act upon the universe, or is it open? The deist says the universe is a closed system, and the atheist says the universe is a closed system, because the atheist says there is no God, so all there is the physical universe, so it's a closed system. It can't be acted upon by something outside of itself, because there is nothing outside of it. The deist says it's a closed system, because God no longer intervenes. But the Christian says it's an open system, because the one who created the universe is the one who guides the laws of nature that he put in motion, and then he is also the one who can supersede the laws of nature by performing miracles. So by calling it the universe open there, what he's saying is that God can intervene. Now, when he applies that to individuals, all he means by that is that we are free. We do have some say in our destiny. Doesn't mean that God's not in control, but it means, you know, you can't go around saying, "Oh, I shouldn't accept Jesus. Why accept Jesus? Because I'm predestined for hell anyway." You know, no, God has given us a certain amount of freedom that enters into the picture. Even the Calvinist, not the hyper-Calvinist, but even the Calvinist would agree that you should try to persuade your friends to accept Jesus, and you should try to persuade your friends to live a better life.
But he does talk about, he almost gets into where he kind of says, "I'm not going to get into this about talking about predestination versus free will."
Yeah.
Because there's the question always comes down to who initiates. Is it a response or is it something?
Yeah, and there are someday I'll write a book on my views on predestination and divine sovereignty and human free will. I'm not really an Arminian, but I think it would be lying to call myself a Calvinist. I do believe in the security of the believer, but I myself don't believe that regeneration precedes faith. I believe that we become born again because we believe, not the other way around. Now, they're great thinkers that believe regeneration precedes faith. And, you know, Calvin, Luther, Augustine, Edwards... I would debate that issue. But you know, you got good people in both camps. I don't think it's something, it's very important, but I don't view it as Calvinism is the gospel. I view it as Calvinism is one way to expound upon the simple gospel message in the scriptures. And I would be in the camp that it would be an incorrect way. Of course, Calvinist scholars would disagree and stuff like that. But
just from a worldview perspective, as it relates to theism, it seems like he was more not so much that God has a that it's not basically. It says theism declares that the universe is orderly and not eternal. Therefore, that means that we have the ability to do things that God doesn't know, doesn't have a plan.
Yeah, well, the thing is, that statement there, that the universe is orderly but not determined, in that context, Calvin and Luther and Augustine would agree with that statement. So he's not... Sire is choosing, like I'm trying to do, he's choosing to refrain from the Calvinist-Arminian debate. And what he's saying is, theism is not fatalistic. Now, there are some hyper-Calvinists that are fatalistic. In other words, you are not a robot. You do make some real choices. Now, the debate between Calvinists and Arminians would be when and where are the real choices made. But basically, he's arguing that theism is not nihilistic. It's not fatalistic, where everything is predetermined, doesn't matter what I do. So don't enroll in Cascade. Don't go to church on Sundays. It just doesn't matter. If I hug somebody tomorrow, it's because I was programmed to hug somebody tomorrow. If I kill somebody tomorrow, it was because I was programmed to kill somebody tomorrow. By the way, if we're going to hold people morally responsible and lock up criminals, that implies that we do have some say in our actions. So the hyper-Calvinist camp, which very few people fall into that category, the Gordon Clarks and stuff, I think that's an inconsistent position. I don't think that's really livable. So that's panentheism. Deism, we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but God created the universe but doesn't intervene. Deism, God created the universe but doesn't intervene. Refutation, 3 points. Number one, creation is God's greatest miracle. Why can't he perform lesser ones? I mean, if God could create the whole universe out of nothing, then, why can't he raise a person from the dead? Okay? So if creation is God's greatest miracle, why can't he perform lesser ones? Number two, the laws of nature are descriptive, not prescriptive. The laws of nature are descriptive, not prescriptive. What I mean by that is like the law of gravity, okay, and things like that, the laws of nature, they describe the way things generally occur. They don't prescribe the way things have to occur. In other words, the laws of nature are the general ways that God has his universe operate, but that doesn't, God's hands are not tied. Okay, moral laws are prescriptive. There's got to be a prescriber, okay? Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. Natural laws are descriptive. We come up with a natural law and say, okay, this is the way it happens and blah, blah, blah. So, if I drop something, it's going to fall down, not up. Okay? At the same time, that doesn't mean that Jesus' ascension to heaven must be a myth because gravity would have pulled him down. No, God is the one who made the laws of nature, so he can supersede them anytime he wants. It was with deism, the overconfidence in human reason. We thought we had the universe all figured out. And we said, oh, guess what? Miracles can't happen. Because they don't make sense with the laws of nature, with our descriptions of nature. See, we took our descriptions of nature and we made them prescriptive of the way things have to operate. Okay? And then point number three, God is the one who made the laws of nature, so he can supersede the laws of nature. God can supersede the laws of nature. Okay, I'm going to try to rush through these and then we'll take a break. Finite Godism, is the view that God is limited because of evil. Four points on this refutation. Number one, a finite God would need an infinite cause. You know, once you make God limited, well then, that God would need a cause or an explanation for its existence, just like we need a cause or an explanation for our existence. The buck's got to stop somewhere, and the only place it's going to stop is when you arrive at the infinite, eternal being that is the uncaused cause of all else that exists. Well, a finite God isn't that eternal, unlimited being. Second point, a finite God doesn't deserve worship. Worship means that you are saying this is the ultimately worthy being. And yet, if God's limited because of evil, and evil might win its battle against God in the end, you know, then why worship the finite God? I mean, you can make a case that maybe we ought to be worshiping evil. And that leads to point number three, a finite God can't guarantee evil's defeat. A finite God can't guarantee evil's defeat. So why side with God if evil might win? And the fourth and final point, evil, the existence of evil does not prove God is limited. Okay, we'll talk about that if we have time when we get into defending Christian theism. The problem of evil and human suffering, and why, how an all-good, all-powerful God could coexist with evil and innocent human suffering. We'll talk about that as when we defend theism. Okay, so evil does not prove God is limited. Polytheism, the belief in many gods. 3 points in refutation here. First is several gods would limit each other. Several gods would limit each other. Now they might say, well, maybe one of the gods is unlimited. Well, guess what? Then that's God, and the other ones aren't God. Okay? Several gods would limit each other. And so that leads to the second point. Limited beings need an unlimited cause. See, you haven't explained why anything, any limited thing exists if all you have are limited beings. Okay? The way Aquinas would argue, one of his arguments, limited beings exist. For instance, I need things outside of me to continue in existence. I need air, I need food, I need shelter, okay? Now let's suppose that we gather all the limited beings that need something outside of themselves for their continued existence. If you gather all these limited beings together, you get one big limited being. One big dependent being that's still dependent on something else for its existence. And the only way to explain the existence of all the dependent beings is by the existence of an unlimited, totally independent being that exists in its own power. Okay? So if you had all these limited gods, they would still need an unlimited cause. In other words, the only way to rescue polytheism would be to acknowledge theism, the belief in a personal God, but then the problem is these lesser gods are not gods at all. And that's the third point. What the pagans have called gods, these lesser gods, these limited gods are actually demons masquerading as gods. In fact, we get our word demon from daimonion, which was one of the Greek words for the gods. And the Christians and the ancient Christians and ancient Jews realized No, what they call the daimonion, those are not gods. Those are demons. Those are fallen angels. And so that's where we got our word demon from. Okay, and theism is the only true worldview, is the belief in one personal God. It's the only view supported by the evidence, and the belief in a personal God that is both transcendent and immanent. Transcendent, meaning that God is beyond the universe and separate from the universe. But also immanent, involved with the universe. The only view supported by the evidence. And we'll talk about that. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about on that when we come back from the break. So theism is the belief in one personal God, the only worldview supported by the evidence. This God is transcendent, beyond or separate from the universe, but also immanent, involved with the universe. Immanent, involved with the universe. Pantheism, metaphysically, we talk about the nature of God. Pantheism is total immanence, because God is not transcendent at all. He's not separate at all from the universe. God is the universe, so that's total immanence. Okay? God is so involved with the universe that God is the universe. Okay? That's metaphysically speaking. But epistemologically speaking, as far as our knowledge of God, because in pantheism, because God is unknowable, from the standpoint of knowledge, the God is totally transcendent, because God transcends rational categories. Now, deism, do you think God is immanent or transcendent in deism? Transcendent, because he split. He created the world, set the laws of nature in motion, and then he left it alone. So he's so transcendent, he's gone. Okay? Pantheism, there's one sense where God is totally immanent. God equals the universe, and he's not transcendent at all, because the universe is God. God isn't beyond the universe. But then, when it comes to our knowledge of God, God is totally transcendent, because God is unknowable. So, just different ways that transcendence and immanence are being used. Okay, we'll talk about, when we come back for the break, we'll talk about evidence for God's existence. And I don't know how much further we'll get than that. So why don't you take a little break right now?